Call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. There is a quorum. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from the March 15th meeting. Anybody care to move the approval of the minutes? We made eye contact with Lee Torkelson, so I think that qualifies.
I'm happy to move the minutes of March 15th, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Lee Torkelson has moved approval of the March 15th meeting, the minutes of the Elections Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Now, do we have an approval of a motion to approve the minutes of the March 17th
Mr. Chair.
Lee Torkelson.
I don't believe we have more than one Dwayne Quam. I mean, I kind of wish we had two, but we only have one. And he's listed twice on the March 17th minutes. And while perhaps some might think he has a dual personality, but in any case, I would try to correct the minutes. I believe he was excused.
Correct.
On March 17th.
So thank you for catching. Thank you for your eagle eye, Lee Torkelson. So with the correction that will be marked as excused, any additional discussion?
Actually, this was pointed out to me by one of the Dwayne Quams.
Okay, fair enough. Any discussion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of approving the March 17th meeting as amended, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. Yes. Okay, so the first item on the agenda is House File 1141. This is my bill. So we've already had a full testimony and discussion of this bill. It wasn't very much. Basically, this is the bill that it's a technical bill. It just changes the word ballot envelope to secrecy envelope in a few spaces. We need it to line up with the location in the Senate. And it was laid over for possible inclusion. So we need to send it to the general register here. So I will move that House File 1141 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Is there any discussion to this bill or to that motion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1141 will be placed on the general register. So then, thank you for your efficiency there, members. So then we move on to what is Representative Coulter Day in the Elections Committee. We have three Representative Coulter bills. The first bill on the agenda is House File 1942. Representative Coulter, would you like to move that House File 1942 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Okay. Representative Coulter has moved House File 1942. Did you want to move the DE1 amendment?
Yeah, I think that'd be the best approach. I'll move the DE1.
Coulter has moved the DE1 amendment. Did you want to, is this just to put the bill in the shape you want?
Correct.
Okay, any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape you would like. Representative Coulter, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to apologize for my voice from the beginning. Thanks to karaoke last night and my kids getting sick, it is not at 100%. So House File 1942, as amended, incorporates various policy changes brought forward by the Secretary of State's office. There are a variety of pieces to this, and many of them are fairly technical, I would say. So I'm going to kind of walk through this section by section in broad strokes. And then Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office can answer questions on the particulars. So Section 1 allows more than one precinct roster to appear on an electronic roster if it's being used for absentee or mail balloting on Election Day. Section 2 allows emergency responders deployed during states of emergency to vote electronically, much the way that uniformed and overseas voters already do. It also allows folks with print disabilities to use this method of balloting. These voters do have to return a printed ballot and signed certificate to their local election official. Section 3 just allows for paper ballots if the information in Section 2 is displayed electronically but still meets the same standards. Section 4 clarifies the title of Subdivision 2 so that it applies to options available to mail ballot voters prior to Election Day. Section 5 outlines a voting procedure that counties may use to allow registered voters living in a mail ballot precinct to vote in person at their county office on election day. Prior to issuing a ballot, the election official must check that the voter is registered and has not already cast a ballot in this election. The voter then must sign the voter certificate and is then issued their ballot. They must cast that ballot and deposit it into the precinct tabulator. Excuse me. Section 6 requires precinct summary statements to include the number of alternative size ballots that were submitted using the electronic voting process. Section 7 states that voters who use the electronic voting process must be given the option of using standard optical scan ballots. Section 8 updates requirements for electronic voting systems based on the changes made in Sections 3, 6, and 7. Section 9 states that election judges who assisted voters using electronic voting systems where there were 10 or fewer of those voters are not eligible to participate in any recounts that may occur. This is obviously to ensure voter privacy. And Section 10 clarifies, I guess, what you could call one of those sort of real quirks of voting that those of us who have been involved in recounts have experienced. It states that when voters opt to vote for a write-in candidate, it clarifies, I should say, that when that vote is sent through the tabulator, that in order for the vote to be counted, the oval next to write-in has to be filled in too. So you can't just write the name on the blank and hope for the best. And I would clarify as well that, of course, if there is ever a recount involving any of those kinds of ballots, that voter intent is what mattered. So in this case, write-ins, even if they didn't fill in the bubble, if there's a recount, they would ultimately be counted because it's voter intent. So that is really the extent of the bill. As I said, Ms. Freeman is here if there are any questions.
Thank you. Is there any member of the public who would like to testify to this bill? Oh, okay. Seeing none. Nicole Freeman, are you just available for questions? Oh. All right. Okay, so we'll close the public testimony. Is there any member discussion?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just, I think I'd like Nicole Freeman to come to the testifier stand. I would guess that she is most capable of answering some questions regarding these procedures.
Sure.
Just trying to clarify, the reasoning behind the changes and how ballots are going to be handled once they're cast.
Pull your mic a little.
Oh, I'm sorry. The oversized ballots, how are they handled? How are they counted? How do they get into the? Is the machine capable of handling them, or are they categorized or counted in some other way?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and respond to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Torkelson. I'm Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. So the alternative size ballots, as detailed here, are the changes made around the sizing of the ballot and use of various electronic assistive voting devices are made to accommodate assistive voting devices that may print a ballot that is a different size than sort of your standard 8.5 by 14 size ballot. It would allow counties to choose varying pieces of equipment that use a different size ballot. And so in order for a county to, as a county is making the decision to purchase that equipment, they would ensure that their tabulators could handle that. And so the ballot size is slightly smaller, not larger.
I guess I'm even more confused. So the ballots are smaller? I thought they were larger.
Nicole Freeman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The ballots that, so there's a few different pieces of equipment that are out there on the market that produce a ballot, that print on a ballot card that is smaller than your standard ballot size. So the 8.5 by 14 or 17 or 18 or 11 is sort of the standard. And these devices print on a ballot card that is about half the size of a standard sheet of paper. And the rest of the text is displayed on a screen, which can be read to a voter through the assistive voting device or through other. And so they can vote either using the touch screen or, you know, a paddle or a toggle, or there's different button devices. Sip and puff devices can be plugged in into this equipment. And so what the they're currently not allowed to be certified in Minnesota because statute requires that all ballot currently requires that all ballots are a standard size. This would allow ballots to be an alternate size.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does the machine then mark the ballot for the voter? How is that? How does this? I'm not familiar with this, so I'm just trying to find out how it works.
Nicole Freeman.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's called an assistive voting device. It essentially acts as a mechanical Sharpie or a mechanical pen. So currently used in a lot of our polling locations, there's a machine called an AutoMark that accepts a standard size ballot and prints the voter selections. There's other equipment out on the market used in a number of other states where a blank ballot card is inserted. The voter walks through their ballot screen after screen after screen for each office, similar to how the AutoMark currently would display someone's ballot in an audiovisual manner. And then based on those selections, the voter can review those selections before printing, and then their selections are printed on that ballot card. That ballot card then is read by the tabulator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the tabulators are capable of accommodating different size ballots, the way it sounds. Then how are those ballots, you know, it's in the event of a recount, I assume those ballots are stored with the others, and that doesn't cause any issues as far as the event of a recount or keeping these ballots safe.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Torkelson. Yes, so the ballots would be deposited into the same ballot box throughout the day as the standard size ballots. At the end of the night, those ballots would, you know, all be collected together and be secured just as a standard practice. The portion about requiring different election judges to participate in a recount is to ensure voter privacy. So if there was just one or two voters, less than 10 voters, according to the bill, that participated and used the assistive voting device to protect voter privacy, election judges who didn't work in that precinct on election day would be selected to do that recount.
Thank you. All right, that's very illuminating. Thank you for that. Then the issue of casting a write-in vote. So this legislation would require that someone casting a write-in would have to darken the circle. Just kind of step through the reasoning behind that and, how those ballots are handled in the event of a recount.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this would put in line a recount vote with at the same level as any other printed candidate. So currently, a printed candidate, if someone selects the printed candidate, they're only counted if that target is complete, tabulated by the machine. In the event of a recount, the election judges of differing parties are able to determine voter intent. And so if, for example, somebody's name was a name was written in on the line, but for a write-in, but the target wasn't selected, then that would be counted at that time in a similar fashion to if someone had circled a candidate's name that was printed on the ballot, that selection, if the election judges determined voter intent, it would be counted at that time.
Lead Berkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the event of, I realize write-in campaigns are rarely successful, and it's a pretty rare occurrence that we'd have a significant number, but in the event that there was a significant number of write-in ballots cast in a particular race out of a ballot of multiple races, The machine would not count, could, it's possible that the machine could miss a number, a significant number of write-in choices because they didn't darken the circle. And in that case, the tabulated numbers would show, perhaps show a winner, whereas a recount could show a different winner. Would, is there some way that that significant number of write-in votes would trigger a recount?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Currently, there isn't anything in statute that would require, based on a number of write-ins, for there to be a recount. Candidates can, of course, request a recount at their discretion and pay for it if it does, if the margin isn't at the state level. I will say there's there are in our administration bill, House File 1140, there were provisions that would allow local jurisdictions, sort of at the city level and lower, to decide by resolution to count write-in votes, individually tabulate them when there was a number of them that put them at or above the lowest number of votes for a printed someone printed on the ballot. So in that case, those ballots would be individually reviewed and individually tabulated.
Thank you. So who would pull that trigger to determine that a recount or a hand count was necessary?
Nicole Freeman.
So that would be based on the number of write-ins that would be that were tabulated. They would then be individually reviewed.
I'm sorry. Again, who would make that decision as to trigger the hand count in a case like that?
That would.
Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That would be the city clerk.
Thank
or
you.
Or the county auditor, depending where it landed.
I'm pursuing this, Mr. Chair, because in the county seat of Watonwan County, there was recently a victory by a write-in candidate for mayor. So these things do happen,
mm-hmm.
And I just hope that there's, you know, significant processes in place to identify a situation where that might be necessary. The last thing I want to ask about is people that receive a mail-in ballot, it sounds like there are provisions in here that they could then come to the polling place to cast their ballot if they didn't get their ballot mailed in. Do they bring their mailed in, the ballot they received by mail, and cast that, or do they receive a new ballot when they come to the polling place?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Torkelson. So the process would work very similarly on election day for these mail-in voters as it would if they came in to vote absentee or if another voter came in to vote absentee. So before issuing a ballot, the election official would ensure that their registration was up to date as well as that they hadn't cast a ballot previously, so by mail or by in-person absentee. And then they would be issuing them a new ballot. Their existing ballot that was mailed to them would be spoiled in the system, and so it wouldn't be able to be accepted at a later date, at a later time.
Lee Torkelson,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
One other member on the list.
Does someone in that situation who's mailed in a ballot, do they have the option of coming in and changing their vote on election day?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Lee Torkelson. So a voter would have the option to, we sort of call it claw back a ballot. They would have the ability to alter their vote up to 7 days ahead of the election under current statute. At the 7 day mark, that's when absentee ballot boards can begin their work. Absentee and mail ballot boards can begin their work and separate the signature envelope from the secrecy and ballot. And so at that time, we can no longer, you know, a county official, not the Secretary of State's office, excuse me, the county official or the ballot board can no longer go in and identify whose ballot is whose because they've all been separated. So they could make that decision in current statute 7 days ahead.
Okay. Representative Altendorf.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a simple question for Nicole. So as we're talking about the mail-in ballots and as these are coming in and this is becoming more popular, is there a way then, you know, for that voter to check that as it goes through the process and is recorded, that it was recorded the way that they intended? Because I just heard you say that, you know, they could correct it up to 7 days prior to the election. So is there a method in Minnesota that we can, you know, as we're mail-in ballot, to build up our confidence that they can check to make sure that it was recorded the way that they intended?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Altendorf. So currently there is a tool on the Secretary of State's website that allows you to sort of track your ballot as it's received and then accepted after Election Day, because no votes are counted until election night, until polls close. So after Election Day, if you looked up your ballot, then it would say that it was counted. There is no method to say, because of voter privacy and voter, you know, a private vote, there's no method to, and again, because you separate the identifying information on the signature envelope from the secrecy and the ballot, again, to so that no one else knows how you voted, it doesn't individually record your votes.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your response, Nicole. I just, you know, Representative Coulter, I just think that, you know, to bring our elections up to the security that we would like and the confidence level that we like, you know, these are the kind of discussions that we should be having. Is there is the technology that, you know, we could be voting and it could be a private individual thing that we could be checking to make sure that our vote counted. And that's really the direction I would like to see us go so that we can build the confidence of the people. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the thing where you don't use a recount if there's 10 or fewer at a location, what if I know of several elections where the difference has been, you know, less than the number of fingers on my hand. Shouldn't there be a exception for if the difference between is less than 10 that you would then recount, you know, that one that maybe has 10 or 9 in it, because that can make the difference?
Nicole Freeman or Representative Coulter?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there may be a little bit of confusion about what this provision states. This bill does not change. I mean, if anyone can request a recount, sometimes costs are paid for, sometimes they're not, but anyone can request a recount. That does not change with this bill. What this states is that in precincts where 10 or fewer voters use assisted voting technology, the election judges from that precinct will not participate in the recount.
Okay.
So it doesn't change anything about the recount process. It's just in order to maintain voter privacy, because there are 10 or fewer voters, you'd probably be able to pretty easy to figure out who voted which way. So that's the idea there.
Thank you. On the 7 days, you know, where you can say, I want my absentee ballot not to because something changed, but 7 days on, there have been discussion about adding 8 additional in-person run-through type voting. How do you handle if a person comes in and votes in person ahead of time, and so it's with that change, it would be more than 7 days before the election if we did add that 8-day, and they vote, but their absentee is in process. I know that we, on election day, check to see if you've, you know, absentee voted or not. You know, we've got some data there. Do we also check on the absentee ballots when they're counted that the person hasn't voted in person?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kwong. So if the timeline of when an absentee ballot board was able to begin processing ballots, or if someone voted using early voting, for example, or if direct balloting timelines where someone's directly inserting into a tabulator, if those timelines were changed, the clawback period would also change as well. And so if the legislation passes, that extends it to direct balloting to 14 days, or I know early voting starts at 18 days in current versions of the bill, that would mean that a voter would not be able to change their ballot after that point.
Representative Kwong?
Thank you. And I'm asking these so that anyone listening can have more confidence that we're looking at these gray areas. But on page 2 of where you've got on line 2.27, any governor of any state, I don't think that our counties or our state sends out anything for other states. And so why do we have in our statute stating emergency declared by the President of the United States or any governor of any state? I would think that that language should state or the governor of Minnesota, because it's irrelevant what a governor of another state would do. But then in general on electronically sending out ballots, I know some people have some concerns about the security of, hacking or other types of things, and that's why I think we should look at this very closely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, seeing no additional members on the list asking questions, Representative Coulter, do you have any closing remarks?
Certainly, and if I could just quickly to that last point, the section that Representative Kwong was referring to refers to emergency response providers being able to use a similar system to what uniformed voters, overseas voters use. And the reason that any governor of any state language is included is because often emergency responders may need to, in the event another governor declares a state of emergency for flooding or natural disaster or something like that, oftentimes emergency responders from other states will respond as well. So that was the purpose there with that language. But just sort of to close, obviously this bill is largely technical in nature, and affects situations generally speaking where there are pretty small numbers of voters. But I do think it makes important changes to better meet voters' expectations and needs, and following those changes along so that questions don't arise later. I think one of the things, and we talked about this yesterday in our meeting, is that, even when it impacts a small number of voters, it's really, really critical to the process to ensure that we're doing what we can to anticipate issues on the front end and to try and address as many eventualities as possible. And so I think that's what this bill does. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Coulter renews the motion that House File 1942 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Coulter, you also have House File 1489. Would you like to move that House File 1489 be recommended to be re-referred to the Taxes Committee?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Coulter has moved that House File 1489 be recommended to be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. Did you want to describe the bill before moving the amendments, or would you like to move the amendments first, Representative?
Why don't I go through the bill first, and then we can have discussion on the amendments.
Sure. Sounds good.
excuse me.
To your bill.
Thank you. So House File 1489 deals with our state's political contribution refund program, one of the real hallmarks of our public campaign financing system. I'm assuming most of us in this committee and anybody who would probably be watching the Elections Committee at 9 a.m. is probably pretty familiar with the PCR program. But just sort of the short version is that Minnesotans are able to claim a credit of up to $50 for individuals and $100 for married couples for political contributions to state candidates and or party units, provided that those candidates agree to spending limits. It's one of the ways that the state of Minnesota has incentivized campaign spending limits and small dollar contributions. The PCR was established in 1990, among other campaign finance and public disclosure law changes, and has remained virtually the same since. I think we're all aware that much has changed since 1990, including the fact that I am no longer 4 years old, with the amount of funding needed to run an effective campaign being another glaring example. This bill would update the PCR program by raising the maximum credit to $100 for individuals and $200 for married couples. Nothing else about the program, including who is eligible to receive or authorize the credit, would change with this bill. So I think, why don't we go ahead, if we could, Mr. Chair, and go ahead with the amendments, and then we can kind of discuss the bill as it looks, if any amendments are adopted.
Sure, sounds good. So would you like to move the A3 amendment, Representative?
Yeah, we can start with the A3 amendment.
Okay. Representative Coulter's moved the A3 amendment. Would you like to describe that one?
Certainly. So the A3 amendment just basically allows for, in this case, it would be the Commissioner of Revenue, because the PCR is administered by the Department of Revenue, to annually adjust contribution limits that would receive this credit, but for inflation, any adjustments would be rounded to the nearest $10.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the A3 amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The amendment's been adopted. Representative Coulter, you have the A4 amendment.
I do indeed, Mr. Chair. And this
so
amendment
Coulter
deals...
Moved the A4
oh, excuse
amendment.
Me. Apologies. Yes, I moved the A4. This amendment deals with another sort of another piece of our public financing system in Minnesota, the state public subsidy grant that candidates receive. And this just basically inserts a blank appropriation into the current statutory language, which would allow us to, because the bill is being laid over, would allow us to potentially come back and add additional funding to that public subsidy program.
Any discussion to the A4 amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendments are adopted. We have four people who wish to testify on this bill. the first is Mary Hartnett. And after Mary Hartnett will be Lily Sassy. If you could please keep your testimony to just a couple minutes, we'd appreciate it. Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify
Thank
yourself
you.
And proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of Clean Elections Minnesota. And I'm testifying on two bills, sorry. A nonpartisan nonprofit that promotes electoral policies that reflect the will of the people and not the power of money. Thank you, Representative Coulter, for introducing this important bill and for introducing House File 1489. We support 1489. Public participation in the public contribution reimbursement program has been declining, and this gives a needed boost. Public financing of elections strengthens our democracy. It increases the proportional importance of small donors and average Minnesotans so that candidates do not depend as much on large contributors, lobbyists, or special interests. They encourage voters to participate in political campaigns, and they limit spending in political campaigns. A study by the Center for Governmental Studies stated that Minnesota's public finance program has for decades been considered one of the finest in the nation, with a high participation rate, a higher participation rate than other states. 85.5% of candidates participated recently. Raising the refund will increase its effectiveness. Last, we ask the author and committee to go one step further and consider supporting the recommendations from the Campaign Finance Board and increase the amount an individual could make to $200 instead of the $100 in the bill, and to $400 from the $200 per married couple in the bill. It will encourage more participation in the program and increase the amount of public financing. We urge your support for 1489. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next testifier is Lily Sassy, and after Lily Sassy will be Hallie Norman.
I think Ms. Sassy would prefer not to testify on this bill, and will testify on the next bill.
Okay, sure, that would be fine. So Hallie Norman would be... Oh, same thing? Okay, sorry. Then our only other signed up testifier is Jeff Sigurdsson. Welcome to the committee, Director Sigurdsson. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Sigurdsson, Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As was mentioned, the board's recommendation on the PCR program was actually for an increased amount of $200 per person, $400 per couple. Unlike the other legislative recommendations by the board, The I didn't frankly press those recommendations in terms of bringing a separate bill to the committee, because I knew that this body and the Senate was considering other options in terms of involving contributors with the public subsidy program. And I knew that there would be a bill that would increase the amount of the PCR program directly. But I did want to highlight the board's rationale for even making this recommendation, which is that the board believes that the current public subsidy program is in fact kind of withering on the vine. And it is losing its effectiveness in providing the stated goals of the program, and may not be able to do so in the future unless there are changes made to that program. For example, the PCR program. In 2007, 58% of all contributions from individuals for candidates who signed the public subsidy agreement were refunded through the PCR program, 58%. In 2008, it was still 45% of all contributions from individuals were refunded through the PCR program, showing then a link between those individuals and the PCR program and its effectiveness in raising funds for candidates. Most recently, in 2020, that amount had dropped to only 16% of contributions from individuals were refunded. In 2021, the last year in which there are numbers available, that number had dropped to only 13% of contributions from individuals were refunded through the PCR program. So the ability of the PCR program to be used to generate contributions from individuals who live in the district or at least live in the state is apparently losing its effectiveness. It also has declined in just pure numbers. In 2002, candidates issued $3.3 million of PCR receipts that were refunded by the Department of Revenue. In 2021, it was an all-time low of $618,000 that were issued by candidates and refunded by the Department of Revenue. So again, the value of the PCR program in terms of attracting local donors to or donors who are not PACs, not not lobbyists, who are limited under the special source limitations to contribute to candidates has declined over the years. I would also quickly, as an aside, say here that I think that there should be a discussion, although not part of the board's recommendation. I believe there is some interest in looking at whether or not the method of issuing a PCR is in fact something that needs to be updated. It's the same process that we had in 2020. It's very paper intensive. You get a receipt from the candidate. You then have to fill out a form, assuming you can find it on the Department of Revenue website. You then have to find an envelope and a stamp, and you then mail it in. It would seem that there would be an opportunity here, regardless of the amount that the body ends up deciding to fund the PCR program at, to modernize that approach and make it more approachable both for contributors and hopefully more effective for the state as well. I know that the checkoff program is not in front of you here, but just briefly, I would also like to say that because it is the second half of the public subsidy program, that frankly, it's in trouble as well. For example, in 1977, 27% of all taxpayers checked off for one of the parties when they filled out the tax form. In 2021, that amount was 3.6%. So from 27% to 3.6%. So I occasionally get questions saying, how come my public subsidy payment is smaller? The answer is because there's less money available. And at some point, I think it's likely that there will be a tipping point at which, the effectiveness of the public subsidy program and meeting the stated goals of that program simply won't occur unless there's modifications to that program. I think that's all I had to say. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to speak on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, we can turn to member discussion. Lead Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a couple of questions directly related to the bill. So the A3 amendment, Representative Coulter, has this language that would automatically increase beyond the $100 that's being established in this bill based on inflation and rounded to the nearest $10. Can you just explain the reasoning behind that and how it would work?
Representative Coulter.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson, for the question. I think, you know, as I mentioned, the numbers are in that the numbers for the credits are the same as they were in 1990. And so I think there is a recognition that if there is interest in continuing the political contribution refund program, that maybe we not wait, you know, 33 years to come back and reevaluate the numbers and hopefully adjust them much more frequently to sort of meet the demands of inflation and the costs of funding a campaign. You know, I think obviously the question of what inflation looks like moving forward, particularly with regards to rounding to the nearest $10, may sort of limit the efficacy of that particular provision. You know, inflation continues as it has been. It's very hard to say, but I think that's an important piece that we need to consider as far as the continued future of the political contribution refund program.
Lead Torkelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just comment on that particular perspective that you're really only addressing one aspect of this program that Mr. Sigurdsson has highlighted. There are numerous issues that should be discussed and evaluated, and we should reach, I think, some kind of a consensus on how we should either make this program more effective or forget about it. A second question, Mr. Chair, if I may, the dot, dot, dots in here regarding the total amount attributed to the program. What happens, Representative Calder, whatever the limit is in the end, what happens when we hit, if we would happen to hit that total appropriation? How does that affect the way this program works?
Representative Calder? Excuse me, Mr. I'm sorry, there was a bit of background noise. Could you repeat your question, please?
Well, thank you. So the limit in the past has been $1,020,000. What happens when that total amount has been allocated in a given year?
Representative Coulter, we can also bring Director Sigurdsson down if that would be helpful.
The public subsidy program, as Director Sigurdsson mentioned, is funded in this case both by the statutory appropriation and by the checkoff, the funding that tax filers voluntarily contribute to it. Director Sigurdsson can correct me if I'm wrong, but the number is what it is, and however much it based on the way that it's distributed, that's the amount of money that's just available for the public subsidy.
Director Sigurdsson, do you have any follow-up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the only clarification I would add is, remember, there's two pots of money. The checkoff amount from the tax form is dedicated to candidates of a particular party. The general account, which is the amount that is the blank, the dot, dot, dot here, is divided up by office regardless of party. So there is kind of two different pots of money here. This one would not affect the checkoff amount. It would affect the base payment that goes to a candidate of a particular office.
I can also say, Lee Torkelson, this amendment was prepared prior to our target coming out, and given the amount, and so that we wanted some flexibility there. So that's the reason the dots were put in. Based on what the target ended up being, as we learned after the amendment was prepared, it's probably not going to be a huge amount over the $1 million that's in here already. So
yeah, no arguments with the amount. I'm really trying to grasp the significance of the ceiling. So if I'm understanding this correctly, the ceiling creates a first-come, first-served situation. If the applications that get submitted for a refund are submitted after we've reached the target, whatever that amount is, there is no more money available for that particular program. Is that correct?
Director,
that's the next bill, I believe.
I think we might be talking about different streams of money here. So the A4 amendment deals with the public subsidy program, not the political contribution refund program. There is no limit to the amount of money that can be used for the political contribution refund program. The amount of money in the A4 amendment would relate to the public subsidy program.
Lead Torkelson?
I'm getting more confused by the minute. So I thought the amount of money in the public subsidy program was determined by the amount of people that check off that box on their tax form. What am I missing here?
Director Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, correct. The number of people who check off influences that pot of money that's divided up by candidates of that party. So if you check off for the Republican Party, that's divided up by all Republican candidates who qualify for the public subsidy payment. The general amount, the general account, which is the account that's being modified here from $1,000,020, that currently the $1,000,020 is divided up by the number of candidates, for example, for House that qualify for a public subsidy regardless of party. So that would increase, assuming that number goes up, that increases that general account payment. It doesn't impact at all the checkoff amount.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somewhere in the catacombs of my mind, I didn't know that. I just, so there's an even distribution of that, whatever the dot, dot, dot amount ends up being. It's distributed to all candidates, and the checkoff dollars are distributed by party based on how many people check off the box on their forms. And with that, I think I understand better where we're at.
Thank you, Lead Torkelson. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, both of you, for this conversation. I think it's really helpful to ground our conversation about our public financing system and the system that was set up more than 30 years ago. I think this is a question for Director Sigurdsson, but as we think about, and I think I heard sort of the values in our public financing system, you know, one is the ability of candidates to be able to run with public money as opposed to PAC lobbyist money. And then the other is to incentivize and really to bring more small dollar, more of our constituents into the process. And I think that's sort of the values underlying the PCR is really allowing folks who are small dollar donors to come to participate and then to get a refund. I'm wondering, like, as we talk about increasing the amount, and I know you probably have done this because of the fiscal note and everything else, if we increase the amount from $50 to $100, do we anticipate that that will bring more people into using it or just refund more money?
Director Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, one technical clarification, because this is outside of Chapter 10A, the board did not participate in the fiscal note. In my opinion, the number of people who will use the PCR program will go up, will be probably more affected by making the program easier to use than by increasing the amount, in my opinion. Again, I believe that the current system is so paper heavy and puts so much of the burden on the donor to be able to get the refund. They have to know, frankly, what they're doing. They have to be willing to spend the time to do it. They have to be able to jump through some hoops. That I don't know that it will increase, in my opinion, I don't know it will increase the number of people who participate, although undoubtedly it'll go up some, but I think that it has to go hand in hand with modernizing the system of issuing the PCR, in my opinion.
Representative Green. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Sigurdsson, and I really appreciate this. As some, I think one of the things when we talk about public financing is probably most of us sitting around this table have some experience. Our treasurers have some experience with this, what I would say. I think I can confirm is a very paper-heavy process. I think for donors who are unfamiliar with it, sometimes it's also a hard sell to say, you know, wait a couple of weeks and you'll get your contribution in the mail. I think that's why when we're thinking about reforming the systems, one of the things we need to think about is the value of bringing more small donors, bringing more of our constituents into this process. We know that actually impacts not just how we run our campaigns, but when folks contribute $5, $10, $15, $20, they're actually more likely to be participate in other ways, including voting. So I really appreciate this, and I think as we have this conversation about our public financing system and how we reform or tweak or whatever we're gonna do with our current system, making it more accessible and really thinking about how we bring more people in. And then I also think as we think about how we're going to spend our resources, really making sure it's an effective way that we're countering the balance and really trying to ensure that it's our constituents, our voters, folks who are just participating because they care about the work we're doing here are at the center of it. So I really appreciate your feedback and expertise, and thank you, Representative Parker, for starting this conversation.
Seeing no additional, Lead Torkelson.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of general comments on PCR. First, you know, certainly the current program is antiquated and deserves to be looked at as far as modernizing it. I know I don't write as many checks as I used to, and I know people that don't write any checks, as a matter of fact, and filling out forms is not appealing. On the other hand, I think it's important to note that there are two times during the life of this program that this program has been suspended, or not funded, I guess, I think would probably be the correct term. And that's occurred in general when we've had a deficit. Given the amount of spending that was revealed yesterday, we very well may be headed for a deficit sometime in the near future. At that time, it's very possible that this program will be suspended again, regardless of how much we are able to modernize it or how much money we're able to put on the dot, dot, dot line. This is a serious consideration, and I think it's worth thinking about.
Representative Bonner, briefly.
Thank you. Sorry, I raised my hand three times. I don't think anybody saw me. So I'm just curious, Mr. Sigurdsson, as you probably know, I have a little bit of an affinity for IT, and I'm curious if there's ever been any consideration, study, or attempts to look at ways to modernize the program technologically, because I can tell you when I talk to donors, I too prefer to have those small dollar donors. In fact, my campaigns have almost exclusively been run by that over the last four cycles. But what I hear from them is, one, sometimes they don't want to bother with the amount because it's just too small to bother with. And the other is, gosh darn it, nobody has stamps anymore, right? And so I'm just curious if we've ever looked at or done any study or evaluation on ways to improve the system electronically, or if that's ever been approached.
Director Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say no, because at least initially there was probably two problems. One, while the Campaign Finance Board is sort of the face for this program to candidates and party units, the Department of Revenue is actually administering the program. And I think the other issue is a hard one, frankly, to get around, which is that the Department of Revenue tracks this to make sure that no one gets more than $50 or $100 per couple by Social Security number. And I don't think we want the board to have people's Social Security numbers. I would at least be reluctant to take on that responsibility. And so there has to be a way of around that. I would suggest that there may be a way of finding a different way of making sure no one gets more than one payment. Perhaps we can use a direct match on name and address that provides sufficient security to the Department of Revenue to say, okay, this is this person, and they haven't received more than $50 or $100 or whatever amount we end up at, and we can go ahead and use that without their Social Security number. If the Department of Revenue can feel secure with not having a Social Security number, then I think it could be built into the software that most committees use to file with the board. You put in someone's contribution, they've indicated that they would like a PCR refund, you click a button, and it's generated automatically in terms of a report that we forward to the Department of Revenue would be one approach. But again, the question is that darn Social Security number, so we have to find a way around that.
Representative Bonner, follow up?
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Seeing no additional member questions, Representative Coulter, do you have any closing remarks?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and just quickly, I did forget to mention that because this is a program administered by the Department of Revenue, this requires a revenue estimate, not a fiscal note. I didn't think to check if that was posted online, but if it's not, I can certainly send it to the committee administrator if members are interested in that, what those numbers look like.
Thank you.
So just in closing, I would say, and this has sort of been alluded to already, that this bill and the one that we're about to take up present us with an opportunity to discuss the future of public campaign financing in the state of Minnesota. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, Minnesota was a national leader in public campaign financing because we had leaders who understood the importance of a politics that is accessible to everyone, not just those who have or are able to easily access great wealth. The PCR program has been integral to that system, and given that this program has not been updated since it was signed into law by Governor Perpich, I think an update is appropriate.
Thank you. With that, Representative Coulter renews the motion that House File 1489, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is re-referred to the Taxes Committee. Finally, Representative Coulter, you have House File 2793. Would you like to move that House File 2793 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Coulter has moved 2793. Would you like to move the DE1 amendment with the... We voted out the previous... Okay, thank you. So Representative Coulter will move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape he would like. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape you would like. Representative Coulter, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe I'm not much of a sports fan, but I believe this is what's known as a hat trick. So one of my favorite lines from a TV show comes from a character, presidential candidate played by Alan Alda. He says, referring to wealthy donors, if you can't drink their booze, take their money, and then vote against them, you're in the wrong business. And while I think we can all agree with that sentiment, I think we're all also fully aware of the immense and corrosive power that money has in campaigns. For nearly 50 years, Minnesota has recognized the sway that big donors can have over candidates for office, and has taken steps to lessen that by providing public funding to candidates who agree to spending limits, as well as limits on contributions from lobbyists and PACs. Excuse me. House File 2793 is a bill that continues Minnesota's proud tradition of leading and innovating in the area of public campaign financing. I will be honest and say that I wish we weren't in a place where this kind of discussion was necessary. Citizens United and other court cases have eviscerated significant and meaningful campaign finance reforms and unleashed a torrent of spending into our politics, the effect of which is immensely damaging. In particular, the amount of money spent by outside groups, many of which are nearly completely shielded from any meaningful disclosure, is, I believe, obscene. The result of this is that voters and non-voters alike are increasingly cynical about elected officials and whom those officials are responsive to, and that the voices of the candidates themselves, the people that voters want to hear most directly from, are being drowned out. And I should say as well that I view this as a problem regardless of whether or not it benefits the party that I consider myself a member of. Our public financing system has not kept up with the times, particularly in a post-Citizens United world. As Director Sigurdsson just mentioned, in 1977, more than a quarter of all income tax filers checked the box to fund the public subsidy. In 2017, and Director Sigurdsson had more updated numbers than I was able to find, that number had dropped to less than 5%. But we have an opportunity to change that, which is precisely what House File 2793 proposes to do. Public financing is one of the most powerful tools we have available to put power back in the hands of candidates to run authentic campaigns and in the hands of voters to reward candidates who speak to what they really care about. House File 2793 establishes a publicly funded program that would match small dollar contributions of no more than $50 with a state contribution. This match would be multiplied by 4 for contributions from residents of the candidate's district and by 2 for contributions from Minnesotans who live outside that district. Contributors must not be lobbyists and may only contribute a maximum of $50. In exchange for participating in the match program, candidates must agree to the spending limits spelled out in the bill. And I will also note that while I'm not necessarily thrilled with this idea of increasing these limits, I do think that part of updating our public financing system is recognizing that campaigns are more expensive than they used to be. And the maximum match amount would be capped at 50% of that spending limit. In short, this bill would incentivize seeking out smaller donations from our own neighbors rather than big moneyed interests who may or may not know what life is really like in our communities. It would make our democracy more accessible to everyone, not just those with access to great wealth, and amplify the voices of regular people who still feel like $100 qualifies as a large contribution. Finally, It would better equip candidates to compete with super PACs and independent expenditure groups by putting them on more equal footing. I wish we had more legal tools available to limit the amount of money that goes into campaigning, but that is not the reality of our post-Citizens United world. Since we have few to no legal options to reduce the power of outside groups or how much money they can raise, our focus must be on increasing the power of regular Minnesotans. That is what House File 2793 seeks to do.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. So we have a few people who want to speak to this bill. If you could please keep your testimony to 2 or 3 minutes, I would appreciate it. First is Mary Hartnett. And after Mary Hartnett is Lily Sass. Sassy, excuse me. Welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of Clean Elections Minnesota. Thank you, Representative Coulter, for introducing this great bill. I'm here to support, testify in support of House File 2793 that provides a four-time match for small donations. Public financing of elections has strong public support. 62% of American citizens support financing and 85% support fundamental change in campaign finance. A public match program will increase the power and influence of small donors and reduce dependence on big money. Match programs encourage legislators to look to all constituents and create a stronger relationship between them. They mean less time spent fundraising by elected officials. They support first-time candidates, can increase the diversity of candidates, and the number of contested seats. It eliminates income as a significant barrier for participation. They limit spending in political campaigns. At a time when the influx of large sums of money in politics threatens the legitimacy of our democratic processes, and when cynicism is increasing among voters, this program becomes even more important. Legislators will not be beholden to special interests that seek to dominate decision-making and will have the funds they need to run effective campaigns. We ask and urge your support for House File 2793. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Lily Sassy, followed by Hallie Norman. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lily Sassy, and I'm the director of We Choose Us. We are a campaign coalition of 35 community organizations working to protect and expand our democracy in Minnesota. We recognize the importance of the vote and have been excited by the work that many of you are doing to protect our freedom to do so. But we also know that having a healthy democracy is about more than just voting. Minnesotans know it too. When we cast our vote, we want it to matter. As we've talked to people across the state, knocking on doors, talking to folks in parks, the thing we run into time and time again is an acknowledgement of the role that big money plays in our politics and a perception that our elected officials are responsive to large dollar donors rather than their own voters. That is in part a result of Citizens United and other court rulings that have made an already inequitable system much worse, hollowing out safeguards we did have and giving the uber wealthy enormous influence. Small donor public financing, which stands on firm constitutional ground even under Citizens United, is one of the most powerful tools in the toolbox to put power back in the hands of voters, candidates, and their staff to run successful, authentic campaigns. Minnesota was one of the first states, as you've heard, to recognize this when we developed our current system of public financing in the 80s and 90s. But as outside spending has increased and the cost of campaigning has become more and more expensive, our system is in urgent need of modernization. The best public financing systems seek to bring in more small dollar donors from all walks of life, incentivize candidates to participate, and make the reimbursement process as streamlined as possible, or even better yet, provide the funds up front or match them to skip the reimbursement process altogether. The proposal before you today will amplify the voices of local constituents while curbing the power of big money in elections. It gives candidates the freedom to run for office and govern independently of wealthy interests. And it allows candidates' voices to cut through the noise of outside spending so that voters, your future constituents, can hear directly from you. As someone who's also managed and staffed candidate campaigns, I want to underscore how important that is. We believe Minnesota can be a leader again and put people, regardless of how much money they make, back at the center of our decision making. We encourage you to consider the match proposal before you today and think about how we can allocate the resources necessary to sustain this program. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Hallie Norman. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Freiberg and committee members, thank you so much for having me. My name is Holly Norman, and I am the Democracy Movement organizer with Minnesota Voice, and I'm here today in support of expanding public financing via HF 2793. Growing up in Seattle, I made my first campaign contribution because of a public financing system. That first donation began a pattern that has continued since, and today I continue to use our PCR system at every opportunity. When I was a new voter, Seattle's system allowed me to participate before I could afford to make significant donations, and today the PCR program allows me to make donations that reflect my desire to participate, not just my financial capacity. Right now, though, we can modernize our system beyond what the PCR offers to us. As a lifelong voter, every ballot I have cast has felt important, but the majority of an election cycle is not spent casting ballots, it's spent talking to voters. As many of us in this room have likely experienced, many of those conversations often end in some version of, I don't feel like my voice matters, a refrain that voters share in spite of the issues that they see impacting their communities every day. Minnesota can and should counter this narrative. We can't control every source of disenchantment with our election system, but one thing that we can control is our ability to amplify the voices of individual voters through public financing. Public financing is powerful because of its ability to help all voters influence the outcome of their elections regardless of financial capacity. When I see a candidate I donated to run an ad that speaks to the issues impacting my community, I know that my donation, not outside spending on their behalf by a large corporation or PAC, helped shape the ad's content. Inversely, when I donate to a candidate because I see them speaking on a certain issue, they know that they're speaking to the needs of their constituents and are incentivized to continue doing so. In either case, a public match program or public financing increases the power of average people in elections. I have been using public financing systems for almost as long as I have been able to vote, and each time I do so, I see again the ways that it makes my and my community's voices that much stronger. It's a step towards leveling the playing field between big and small donors, and it's shown to increase participation among young people, people of color, and working class voters. The match program in front of you today is an important step in bringing our campaign finance system into 2023 instead of 1990, and would help to ensure a robust, sustained public financing system for all Minnesota voters. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak, and I strongly encourage you to support HF 2793.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify to this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'll close public testimony. First of all, just so members are aware, there is a letter of support in your packet. It promoted our ABLE committee administrator to an elected official. We received 67 identical letters along these lines in a zip drive, all signed by different people, but the text of the letter was the same. We only printed off one rather than printing 67 copies for each member, but if members are interested, we could forward the zip file to you if you want to see the names of the 67 people, but I did want to note that for the record. We do have an A3 amendment. I think it might make sense to turn to that first just so we can get through that. Is there a member who would like to offer the A3 amendment? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer the A3 amendment.
Representative Davis offers the A3 amendment to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment provides that Minnesota residents are allowed to donate up to twice the current number of individual contributions. So it increases it from $1,000 to $2,000, and it would not apply for the special interests or PAC lobbyists. This would empower the individual Minnesota resident. We've heard a lot today that money doesn't go as far as it used to. $1,000 does not go as far as it used to when we came up with these rules. And again, it would be empowering Minnesotans at the grassroots level. I would ask for a yes vote on this amendment, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Coulter, I'll let him speak to the amendment, then Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Davis, for your willingness to engage in the conversation on this bill. I'm always willing to, as I hope you know, always willing to have that conversation. Respectfully, I do not support the A3 amendment, and I'm going to encourage members to not support it as well. It does a number of things. It does, it also, in addition to what Representative Davis laid out, it deletes the four times in-district match, so it would remove that incentive for candidates to seek out donations from our neighbors. It, as Representative Davis did mention, it deletes the contribution match cap and the $50 contribution limit. You know, again, the purpose of this bill is to incentivize small donors. It is to incentivize that kind of grassroots politics. And, you know, I guess I would say, as I said before, there are a lot of folks in my district for whom $100 is still a pretty big contribution. So I think this amendment would fundamentally take the bill in the opposite direction that we need to go and would, in fact, only further empower wealthier donors, which is, I think, not what we should seek to do.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I first heard it, what came to my mind was, frankly, Minnesota voices should be dominant, and that outside the state of Minnesota, there should be a lower limit to the donations, and thus the volume of the voice from outside the state. So I guess I'd like the idea saying we're going to limit lower if you're an outside someone from a different state trying to influence our Minnesota election. You should not be able to give as much as a Minnesota citizen that not only is voicing in the election, but has to live with the consequences of the outcome where somebody outside the state of Minnesota, you know, frankly, it has no effect on their personal life, but it does on us. So we ought to have the capability of being contributing more than someone outside the state of Minnesota. So I like that intent. I understand there, especially when you throw in the DE and change the bill, it gets a little bit more convoluted.
All right. Thank you, Representative Wong. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this may actually be a question for staff, because I'm just trying to figure out what this amendment does. So the way I read it, in addition to remove, so I think that we'll get to the discussion of the bill, but the bill currently is really focused on small donors, those folks, and it caps the match at $50. You give $50, it gets matched. I think what this bill does is eliminate that $50 limit and says if you give $1,000, you'll have a $1,000 match. I also think in the bill there's a limitation on how much an individual can give, and this eliminates that too. So presumably you could give $100,000 contributions, and those $100,000 contributions to different candidates would all be matched. So to me, this is exactly the exact. So one, I guess this is a question for staff. Is that an accurate? Did I just read that right? Is that about what it does to the match limits on both individuals and then the cap?
Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, so the amendment does delete subdivision 2, which is the eligibility that includes the cap that you're talking about. So the answer to your question is yes.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. One additional question. Does the amendment delete the prohibition against matching lobbyist contributions?
Mr. Guerin, when you're ready.
Chair, Representative Greenman, that's also part of subdivision 2 that's being deleted.
Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. So this amendment says we're going to add lobbyists to a program that's really meant to incentivize into what Representative Quam said. I think we really should be focusing on the voices of Minnesotans, and particularly Minnesotans in our district. And it unleashes a match to folks who are giving up to $1,000. In my district, too, $50 may be a lot of money. $1,000 is a lot of money. And so I guess I would say I think this moves us in the wrong direction as it relates to this program, but also just in general to our limits. And I strongly oppose this amendment, and just wanted to make sure I was clear about what you were trying to do.
Representative Davis.
Well, again, I'd like to be clear on what I was talking. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for that. I want to be clear on what the intent of the amendment was to do. The intent was to empower, we're empowering the amount of tax dollars we can give to a campaign. The intent was to increase the amount that the individual, apart from getting tax dollars to fund campaigns, for the individual, because, you know, we've probably all got people who support our campaigns who would like to door knock for us or do more for us, and they can't because they're working full-time jobs or plus full-time jobs. And one way they can get more involved, again, the grassroots Minnesotan, to increase their giving. And that's what the intent of the bill was. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our intent of the amendment, excuse me.
Okay. Representative Coulter.
Just very briefly, and I Representative Davis, I appreciate what your intent is with the amendment, but I think Representative Greenman laid out pretty well what the actual effect of the amendment would be, and I continue to oppose it as well. And I did also want to clarify to Representative Quam's point that, and this is not in a section that would be deleted by this amendment, but in order for a donation to qualify for the match, if you look at line 3.29, the contributor does have to be a Minnesota resident. So the match would not apply to any donations at anyone of any size that any candidate received from somebody who is not a Minnesota resident.
Okay. So,
just to clarify that.
Thank you. I'm getting a few more members who wish to speak. I do want to make sure we have some time to talk about the bill overall. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I will pull the A3 amendment, but I look forward to, after committee, Representative Coulter, working with you about the intent of the amendment.
Okay.
Would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. The amendment has been withdrawn, so we will turn to the bill. Member discussion. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the intent of the bill is to replace fundraising with state contributions. And I think that is a thing we can debate about the quantity and how much. My earlier statements weren't about the matching. It was all about you're changing the limits that can be raised. And I think you should change the limit at which a Minnesotan can contribute towards a campaign and keep the lower limit for people outside the state, because the bill doesn't just do the, oh, we're going to add a matching, and the DE on the first page, it more than doubles the total of that you'd be able to raise and spend in a campaign, and therefore I would like to bias it towards that increased amount of money coming from Minnesotans and not outside.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coulter, I'm sure you've, just a quick question, then a follow-up question. I'm sure you've heard as much as I have in this committee how we need bipartisan support when it comes to the Elections Committee, correct?
Representative Coulter.
I have heard folks state that in this committee, yes. I think that was your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Coulter. All right, Representative Coulter. So do you have bipartisan support on this particular bill?
Representative Coulter.
You know, Mr. Chair, I didn't. I printed off the DE. I did not print off the original bill, so I don't recall who all the co-authors are. I have not whipped every single member of the legislature on their support for this bill. The short answer is I can't say for certain. I would also again state that this bill is being laid over for possible inclusion. So there is, you know, any concerns that folks may wish to address, there will certainly be an opportunity to do that. I always welcome bipartisan support. I have, from members of this committee, sought out bipartisan support on bills and have signed on, not to folks in this committee, but to bipartisan bills as well. So I certainly always welcome that.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He actually answered my next question. Thank you. I look forward to working on this bill with you in a bipartisan way. Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coulter, I want to first thank you for the donuts, but perhaps you should have brought in a box of dots. Again, we have a bill before us with no appropriation listed. We're going to throw taxpayer dollars at this program. So in this program, I got a little off track of the previous bill, but in this program, we're going to have a ceiling established by the whatever number gets replaces your dots. What happens when we hit that ceiling, and is this particular program a first-come, first-serve appropriation?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you noted, obviously there was a blank appropriation, and the hope in drafting the language this way was that the appropriation, I mean, there is sort of a maximum amount. I mean, at a certain point, there are only so many candidates for so many offices, and the hope would be that the appropriation would cover the need out there. Again, the match is capped at 50% of that spending limit. But as I said, I think the concept would be that the appropriation would cover the need that would the amount of funding that would be requested in this program.
Lead Torkelson, follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 4.25, it actually says first come, first serve. And as I noted earlier, taxpayer dollars are not limitless. Again, the amount of spending that's been proposed this biennium to me indicates that the money's going to run out. We're probably headed for another deficit, at which time this program, as others, would be severely limited the amount of resources available. And a first-come, first-serve program like this, you know, to me just doesn't really seem fair that somebody who's able to hurry up and get organized and apply for this money would have a tremendous advantage. Again, I think that this program could fall differently depending on the geography of a person's district and how easily it is to quickly access a bunch of voters to claim the money that's there on the first-come, first-served basis. This is dramatically different from what I think would work well in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I just think this, I know this being laid over, but I'd sure like to vote no.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to sort of bring us back to the reason we need this change, I'm wondering, Representative Coulter, if you have thoughts on how this may sort of impact or change the behavior of candidates and the behavior of folks in the district as we talk about, you know, how we fund our campaigns and how people run their campaigns.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman, for the question. I think to the point that I made earlier, it certainly does incentivize seeking out small dollar contributions, and in particular the way it's designed currently, small dollar contributions from within districts in which candidates are running, our neighbors, the folks that we are that we are running to represent and serve. And to my mind, I think that's a very laudable goal. I think, you know, the more that we can place accountability, the more that we can emphasize accountability from our neighbors, from the folks that we are elected to represent, the better. And I said it earlier as well. I think, one of my personal values when it comes to campaigns is, you know, the idea that I would much rather not have to rely on big contributions. I will say, and I don't know if I speak for everyone, but I suspect I speak for a few people, that the part I hate the most about campaigning is raising money. And to be able to do that more efficiently, to be able to rely more exclusively on folks that I know better, the folks that I see at the grocery store and on caucus night and all of that, that to me has great appeal and would make the idea of running for office, I think, much more accessible to a lot of folks. And I think we talk a lot about an inclusive democracy, but I think to me that includes an accessible democracy, and that's why I think this is so important.
Brief follow-up?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Coulter. And I think I share Representative Quam's interest in making sure that we can fund our campaigns, not just from Minnesota, but to the extent possible from the folks in our district who are electing us. It's one way that folks can show support. And I really appreciate, actually, the way that this is structured so that the match is greater for folks, for your constituents, understanding that that might be a little harder to do, right, than tend to go sort of to where the money is, but that we're going to incentivize that. So I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of this program to impact and I think to get the values that we're talking about, which is being able to run campaigns with Minnesotans, with our constituents at the center. So thank you. And the last thing I will say is, as we're thinking about both resources now and into the future, it really is, to your point, an investment in sort of the basic infrastructure of how we do things. We know that money matters, and if we can do it rooted in the voices and the folks of our district in Minnesota, we'll make better decisions here. So thank you for this bill.
Thank you. Seeing no further members wishing to speak, do you have any closing remarks, Representative Coulter?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and I do just want to reiterate, I'm assuming you all saw the target that came out. I don't know if laying it over for improbable inclusion is a proper motion, but I think there will certainly be opportunity to move forward and work on this language. I do sincerely hope in a bipartisan way. I am absolutely committed to that work and always open to having conversations. But I think this is a conversation worth continuing. So just sort of in closing, I know we all believe very strongly in our democracy. I don't think we would be elected officials, and I don't think we would want to serve on the elections committee if we didn't. And I know we all care very deeply about who is responsible for making the decisions that affect millions of Minnesotans in countless ways. In much the same way we fund other important services to keep our state in good shape, public campaign financing is, as Representative Greenman just wonderfully put, an investment in our democracy, in the health of our body politic, if you will. We cannot change the fact of Citizens United, much as we may wish we could. But we can, and I believe Minnesotans want us, to show that our elections don't belong to outside dark money groups or the wealthy. They belong to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Your reference to improbable inclusion fills the chair with deep sadness. But with that, Representative Coulter renews the motion that House File 2793 be laid over for possible sad inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
If you haven't already, please take a donut.
Okay. Thank you for providing the donuts, Representative Coulter. So seeing no further discussion and nothing else on the agenda, this committee is adjourned.